Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you. It is almost Christmas, Rob. We're here, and it's exactly where we don't belong, but here we are anyway. So what's going on in New York?
Yeah, it's Christmas Eve for a start, right? Which is wonderful and shocking at the same time, because I thought we'd be doing a Christmas post-mortem by now. But the fact is, of course we belong here. We're Jews. So... It's from this to Chinese food. What other options do we have?
That's right. If it wasn't for Jews, there wouldn't be any Christmas. So, you know, you gotta...
That's right.
Now, I always start out by asking you, how's everything going in New York City? But right now, the answer is so completely crocked, I don't even know where to begin. So let's start with the New York City Housing Authority. What's happening?
Hang on. Let's start with a couple of things. One... It's rainy here yet again.
Yeah.
Two, I'm off work this week, thank God. So that's why I'm in a much jollier ho-ho-ho frame of mind while, you know, kicking the show off. I'm sure I'll get a little bit more salty as we roll along.
Sure.
And three, I don't want to talk about the Jets or the Rangers. So.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about the Bills either, but, you know.
I'm just going to say this much. Forget the Jets, because they obviously did what they have done now, mastered to an almost fine science of losing at the most inopportune moment, this time in overtime.
Yeah.
Okay. The Rangers went to a shootout. Henrik Lundqvist is in goal. You can guess how that ended. Oh. It was a Rangers win. If I hear any more people saying, poor Henrik, I'm going to start cutting bitches. And that's it. Okay. So the New York City Housing Authority, which you've heard us talking about on several occasions, is beyond disaster. And I do mean beyond disaster. You have people who have been living for X amount of years. We're talking about possible decades at this point, in the most atrocious conditions possible, in these decrepit, decaying buildings that the city is responsible for overseeing and maintaining. These people still pay rent. You know, this is low-income housing. And when I tell you this isn't fit for animals, de Blasio manages to not answer any questions. If you're listening to the show and you're in the New York area, you know how he is, especially when it comes to any kind of questioning by the press.
Yep.
You know, he's as arrogant and condescending and belligerent as the day is long. So there have been numerous scandals that have been broken by the press over the last, I'd say, 2.5 years, and certain apartments being showcased on various news channels, and just the obscene conditions that these buildings and apartments are in. The one that I'll never forget is the family that was asleep and all of a sudden heard the sound of their baby crying when part of the ceiling collapsed on her.
Ugh.
Now, thankfully, she wasn't hurt. She was just covered in dust. It could have been a massive tragedy. But the bottom line is, this is de Blasio's responsibility. So, of all people, Ben Carson, the director of HUD, came to New York last week to meet with de Blasio. And it should be noted that the woman who is in charge of HUD in the New York area is the one who reported de Blasio. Good for her.
Yeah, no kidding.
Good for her. And the short version, because, of course, Carson was gone before any questions could be raised. De Blasio really didn't want to talk about it. He did the usual, it was a very productive meeting, and dot, dot, dot. But he wouldn't answer a single question. Suffice it to say that HUD New York has placed NYCHA as the worst landlord in New York City. They usually have a compendium of, you know, individual landlords / management companies, and this time NYCHA was it.
Jeez, oh
and
man.
De Blasio is just completely fobbing it off and saying, well, you know, it's a list for individuals, and no, you're the worst landlord in New York City. You're also the guy who owns buildings of your own, and you constantly increase rent on your tenants.
Yeah.
But it's another story entirely. So the short story is, he has until January 31st to come up with some kind of viable plan, or Carson and HUD will find them in default and take over NYCHA.
So think about that position. First of all, you have a list of the worst slumlords really in the world, because if it's the worst in New York City, it's the worst in the world, and you're worse than any of them. and you're the mayor. So then you take it and you say, okay, how are we going to fix this thing? I know, we'll bring in Ben Carson. If Ben Carson is capable of doing a better job than you at anything other than potentially brain surgery, yeah, you need to leave. You need to go right now.
It's really an ugly, ugly scenario. I mean, for God's sakes, John, we're talking about the projects, and it's hard enough for people who live in the projects to begin with.
Right.
The fact that they can't go home and cook a meal or get hot water or heat when it's bitter cold. You know, never mind rats and garbage and the fact that these buildings aren't maintained, but it's always excuse upon excuse upon excuse by de Blasio. Well, it was other administrations. Well, it was this. Well, it was that. Well, the buildings are old. Well, you're the one who campaigned and promised to these folks in particular in exchange for their vote.
Right.
So step up to the plate. Or get out of the office that you're not fit to serve in.
Well, I know we're going to talk much more about this a little bit later on when we get into the national politics portion of this. But, I mean, you think about that and how many times have we talked about, oh, it's not my fault, it's Mnuchin, or it's not my fault, it's the Fed, or it's not my fault, it's this or it's that. I mean, that same mentality. I don't give a crap that one of them is on one side of the, you know, one's a Republican and one's a Democrat. Who cares? It's the exact same mentality. It's the exact same lack of execution, and it's the exact same jump to blaming somebody else for it whenever you screw something up or ignore it to the point that it fails.
Well, isn't it ironic? He forced out the director of emergency services, but he didn't force out the director of NYCHA,
right,
saying she's doing a great job.
And she reported him. Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, I'll tell you what. Sooner or later, this all has to, you know, the ice has to melt underneath him, because he has proven time and again that he is not fit for any kind of public service whatsoever. Mm-hmm. He should just go back to Brooklyn and be the shitty landlord that he is and stay the hell away from the public at large, because he's a menace to the city.
Yeah.
You know, I've lived through mayors since Lindsay took over, and I actually think de Blasio was a worse mayor than Abe Beame. I thought Abe Beame, and I'm sure many people don't even remember because he only served one term as mayor, you know. I thought to a degree that Dinkins was the worst mayor we've had, but no, de Blasio is the culmination of both Dinkins and Beame.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a shame. It really is.
Right. And the mentality was the same with Beame. Well, you know, we got money troubles. Let's put an accountant in there. That'll fix everything. Not really so much. So, yeah, what are you going to do? But there are other things going on. It's, you know, it's funny because I spent the last week in a city in which I do not reside, because I was doing a little radio on KMBZ in Kansas City and had an absolute blast there. And, you know, for as little, I mean, it's only about a 4-hour drive from here to Kansas City. So for as little time as it would take to get there, I'm starting to really regret not spending more time there. I mean, you and I have talked about this before, that it's also only a 4-hour drive from St. Louis to Memphis, and I don't get down there anywhere near enough. And I love that city as well. Kansas City is a blast, man. It's fun. And you know what? If you're in a place, and I don't want to dog St. Louis, I don't want to sit here and go, oh, I hate this place, because I don't. I've lived here for 20 years. I like it here, but it has some real identity problems. And, you know, it's still very much got one leg in the past. It's got a real inferiority complex that I do not understand. St. Louisans are way too quick to point out their failings and way too slow to point out their achievements and the cool stuff that's around here. And they do not appreciate it. I don't get it. I never did. But Kansas City has none of that. It's very much an open, hey man, cool, whatever you want to do, just bring it in here and have a good time, because we all are. And it's great to be in a city like that, that really sort of understands itself and is okay with itself and just exists. And I can't say enough about it. I mean, if you've never had a chance to go to KC, go vacation, have a good time, go someplace where you normally wouldn't, maybe if you're one of these, you know, out on the edges type people and you don't venture into flyover country very much. Kansas City's got so much to recommend it. Just go and have a good time and eat. Oh my God, are you going to eat?
Well, you got KC barbecue. For yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. You know, it's probably, you know, on the professional scale, second to Memphis barbecue.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt.
I mean, personally speaking, I'll take Memphis, and then I would take Georgia barbecue, very closely followed by Carolina barbecue.
Right. Yeah. With the mustard based stuff. Yeah, that's really good too.
That's just personal taste, you know. What you were just saying about a city, you know, with an identity crisis. I wish I knew what New York's identity was, because we don't have one anymore.
Yeah, I know. Right. And for the longest time, it had a great one.
Well, because we were all New Yorkers.
Right.
New York is not occupied by New Yorkers anymore. These are all out-of-towners, reverse carpetbaggers, trust fund kids. There's nothing New York about New York anymore. You go into the city, and it's just tourist trap after tourist trap after tourist trap. There's I was thinking about this earlier today too, because we were taking a drive, since it was a quiet day and barely anyone out, and we just thought, let's get out of the house for a little bit. I'm not one that sits around mired in nostalgia or bemoaning the past. I understand businesses close because people who've owned them for a lifetime may retire and times change, but the fact that so much of what we had here alone is all just franchises, you know, and generic nothingness. Because we passed by where one of the old shopping centers was, and there was, you know, the old movie theater we'd go to, and the ice cream parlor, and the clothing store, and, you know, staples of Staten Island specifically, certainly. And it was all bulldozed and razed at the end of last year to make way for, you know, the, I think it's called Alamo Cinemas, where they – Alamo Draft – excuse me, Draft House.
Okay.
Where they have like the multiplex dine-in cinema experience.
Yeah.
All these prefab, you know, Applebee's type places. And it's just very it's depressing is what it is. But it's not just Staten Island, New York City itself. I mean, Brooklyn has been overrun by – certainly by non-Brooklynites. And I think the answer is because we've all left New York, save for a few of us like me. And I'm sure my time is coming.
Yeah, right.
I have to. I just for my own sanity and peace of mind. New York has been overrun by outsiders. And if I sound chauvinistic, I think I'm justified. I was born and raised here, and the city has just been taken over by people who come here with an idea of what they think New York and New Yorkers are. And it's a fallacy, and it's embarrassing, and it aggravates me to no end. So what you were just saying about, you go to someplace like Kansas City, you know, every time that I've gone somewhere, I just always have found the people to be nothing short of absolutely lovely and helpful. You know, I relayed the story to a lot of people when I came back from my trip to Atlanta, and we'd gotten off the train and took the first bus, but we weren't sure what bus to connect to get to the aquarium. And we were in Five Points, not to be confused with Little Five Points, which is allegedly, you know, Badlands, okay, for whatever it's worth. And everyone was going like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. All I can tell you is we asked several people which buses to connect to, and went, and every person took the time and stopped and said, go over there, then you cross over to over there. Wait for the bus that's coming this way, and make sure you tell them that you want to go to the aquarium. And, I mean, everybody was fantastic.
Yeah.
And nice. And we didn't feel any sense of danger because it's supposed to be a bad neighborhood. The people were great. The people are kind, and they take the time to help you out, you know. And I don't find that in New York. Except for when somebody asks me directions, because I'm a New Yorker and I know where the hell I'm going.
Yeah, right.
I take the moment when somebody says, can you tell me where such and such is? And I have to think about it so I don't give them the wrong directions. And I just say, okay, you can walk two ways. You can walk straight ahead and take this train to such and such and then walk 10 minutes. Or you can walk over to such and such train where you'll take it to XYZ stop and walk 1 minute. You know, because real New Yorkers – native New Yorkers, born and raised New Yorkers who may still be here, which we are a minority now, we are genuinely nice people because we're on top of everything. We have to be. We're aware of everything at all times. So I don't know how many of us there are actually left.
No. And what you're describing is the same thing that Orlando did. And I mean, obviously they did it a lot with the influence of Disney and all of that, but you take whatever your city is and then you have outsiders come in, and they take their vision of it and build sort of a parody of it. over top of what's already there. And when you start making something tourist friendly like that, I mean, what do you hear from tourists most often? I just want to be safe when I travel. Well, okay, reality isn't safe. Okay, so you have one of two ways you can go. You can make it safe and unreal, or you can have people come to the place where you actually exist. And it sounds, I mean, a long time ago, Orlando decided to make itself safe and unreal. So it sounds like New York is starting to go through those same kinds of growing pains, and it's a terrible tragedy because nothing. I mean, think about it. What was the last great thing to come out of Orlando, Florida?
Orlando Solar Bears?
It's like, you'll be thinking for a while because there's nothing there. There's no incentive to do anything but make people comfortable. And if that's all you're doing, then you're just a giant service industry. And it's nobody wants to live in that.
Well, you know, speaking of New York and tourists, this is kind of fun news for me to share. Remember that awful woman who ruined everybody's 4th of July by being selfish and climbing up onto the Statue of Liberty?
Oh, yeah, for a cause, right? Well, didn't she have a banner she was waving or something?
She has 50,000 causes because she's a professional agitator.
Okay, right.
So, folks, I say this in all seriousness. There is absolutely nothing altruistic in what this woman does. She doesn't want to work for a living. It's that simple.
Right.
She couldn't make it as a physical trainer. So she uses these ridiculous left-wing lunatic causes, and I'm using the word causes in quotation marks, as her way of, you know, getting arrested, suing somebody because she sues everyone for everything, and for getting people to foot her bills. You know, standing in the ferry terminal, screaming at the top of her lungs, wanting donations, having GoFundMe pages, etc., etc. Long story short, she finally went on trial for that cute little stunt from July 4th. It was a bench trial, didn't take long. She was convicted on all charges.
Good. Good.
So the sentencing will be on March 5th, and the sentence is at least 18 months. At the very least, at 18 months.
Good. They'll get her out of everybody's hair for a year and a half. Yeah, she's a professional attention whore.
Exactly. And the fact is that, God help me, she still lives in my building. Let me just say, she's an asshole of a human being. So I don't feel one bit of anything for her except, I'm pleased as punch. I really am that she's being dragged onto the carpet, deservedly so, because she's a rude and nasty individual.
Right.
So there's nothing redeeming about her, period. She's what you could easily call, under the definition, a piece of shit.
Yeah. Well, let's shift it up then a little bit and talk about the upside. I mean, what it really means to be from New York, what it really is to have that in your background, because in our sad goodbyes and fond farewells segment this week, we say goodbye to a girl from the Bronx, and a girl who ended up becoming one of the most professional and one of the most talented women in cinema from beginnings on a sitcom. I mean, you remember Laverne and Shirley spun off of Happy Days, and she was on screen and held her own. And if you want to go back and look at something Penny Marshall did and remember how incredible she was, all you have to do is find the episode of Happy Days where Fonzie called her to be on a date with Mork from Ork. Because remember that show, Mork and Mindy, also spun off of Happy Days. And that bit, and it only lasts for about 4 minutes, but when she's on screen with Robin Williams, and he's unknown Robin Williams at that point, and is at the height of his frenetic insanity, that crazy brand of comedy that he sort of stole a little bit from Jonathan Winters and then parlayed into his own thing. And she's with him step for step, and she's delivering punchlines as well as he is. And it's one of those incredible TV moments that we were privileged because of our age to be able to see happen live. And then you look at the work that she did as a director and everything else, but it all started with that stint on Happy Days, then, you know, spinning off to her own show with Cindy Williams. Incredible work. And she really was, over her 75 years, responsible for a ton of just top-notch entertainment.
Well, don't forget she started off as being a sort of recurring character on The Odd Couple.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
She played a secretary named... Now, was her name supposed to be pronounced Myrna? Because it was looking at Myrna Turner, but
right.
She pronounced it Myrna, and she had a boyfriend named Sheldon, which didn't have the O in it. So officially, because they misspelled it on the birth certificate.
Right.
So boyfriend's name was Sheldon. That was another running gag, but she, you know, I remember that that first time that she was on Happy Days, and it was she was Fonzie's date.
Yep.
And Richie was going to be paired up with Shirley, and it was just, you know what it was? It made a show that was so safe, quote unquote, and so neutral, or really neutered, and made it a little bawdy, which
yep.
they weren't prone to do. And yet, her going toe-to-toe with Robin Williams and his coked-out Jonathan Winters-isms.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. There's no way around that one. You
right.
know? But, the thing is, anytime Robin Williams appeared, especially on Happy Days, because he did a couple of stints on there, it was hysterical. The first one aside, you know, where it took shape that would become another spin-off series. But when he goes back to visit them in the 50s, and he's telling them that he's living in the 70s.
Right.
Just brilliance. Laverne and Shirley, I thought, was kind of a... I don't know. I always felt like she got the short end of the stick, to be honest with you, because A, it wasn't that funny. It was more Lenny and Squiggy who
right.
were funny.
Yep.
Hello. And and most people don't remember who Lenny was.
Oh, yeah, right. Michael McKeon.
That's right. David St. Hubbins.
Yes, right. And the guy who played Squiggy went on to do the movie Used Cars, which is another one of those forgotten classics.
David Lander.
Yep.
Who also does a ton of cartoon voices, not surprisingly. I
mean, right.
Squiggy was definitely a cartoon character.
But, you know, that you look at the work that she did, you know, later on, repairing with Robin Williams to do a semi-serious movie like Awakenings.
It was a very good movie. Very good. She was, I think, you know, apart from the fact that she was really good, I hate to say it, she was better as the obvious straight man.
Yep.
Because I always felt like the Shirley character was goofy.
Right.
But she was an excellent director. And, you know, I think that was her even greater strength than trying to be a comic actor.
No doubt. But yeah, I mean, she was an incredible talent, and she seemed to be comfortable in anything, in any role that showbiz handed her, she thrived.
And she also seemed to be a very well-loved person, which is the most important thing of all, because, you know, in entertainment, across the board of entertainment, whether it's film, television, music, you always hear how, you know, people are always equated with the characters they play. But you never hear about them off screen unless it's something really atrocious.
Yeah.
And she seemed to have been very well loved. So it's always nice to hear those little remembrances of warmth and kindness when somebody passes.
No doubt about it. So, and well deserved for Penny Marshall. What a great body of work. So good for her legacy and for everybody that it was a fan of hers over time. You and me, it sounds like, included in that. And like we said, not bad for a young girl from the Bronx.
Here's one more little thing that's a post-mortem on New York. The bane of my baseball existence, Matt Harvey, is headed to the California, Los Angeles, whatever the hell they're called, Anaheim Angels, for 1 year, but I can't believe the amount of money they were stupid enough to give him, $11 million deal. I guarantee you his arm blows out just at the end of spring training.
Well, yeah, well, the Angels do have a history of doing that. I mean, remember how long it took Albert Pujols to produce anything for them after they opened up the checkbook for him.
I got slaughtered for saying it seems to me that the Angels are where a player's career goes to die.
Yep.
Pujols, now Harvey. Harvey, this is the end. I'm sure of it. Josh Hamilton, you know, it's a never-ending list. You know, the only players of merit that I can think of that came out of Anaheim for the long term, and certainly this one was by trade, was, of course, Nolan Ryan going from the Mets to the Angels. But then he left the Angels and went to Houston and still had an amazing career.
Right. Yeah, started throwing no-hitters every couple of weeks right. or whatever.
Rod Carew had already peaked with Minnesota by the time he got to the Angels.
Yep.
Can't really think of anybody else because, you know, like by the time Reggie Jackson or Joe Rudy had made it to the Angels, it didn't mean anything. They were well past their prime. Am I missing anybody? I mean, the Angels at one time had one of the best pitching rotations with Mark Langston, Jim Abbott, and Kevin Tappany, and they lost all of those guys.
Right.
So I fail to see the validity of the Angels franchise as just being an annoyance.
No, but like you said, it gets Matt Harvey permanently out of your hair.
Yes. I'm telling you right now, John, because he's due. You know, he didn't pitch in 2015. Or was it 2016? No, he didn't pitch in 2016.
Yeah, right.
Or 2017. And then when he came back at the beginning of this year, had all those problems with the Mets, having the yips aside, which he wouldn't address, and then finally getting himself not only designated for assignment, then traded, and having a less than mediocre season with Cincinnati, it's time for his arm to go, because it'll now be 2 years.
Right.
And that seems to be his clock, really.
You know, one more, it seems like we're doing a theme show all themed around New York this time, but there is something else that's going on kind of in New York. Well, actually right in your backyard. What's MTV doing to Staten Island?
I have to compose myself for a moment, because this is just infuriating beyond words, and I mean infuriating, and I don't really want to go off on a sputtering rage right now. There's a new series that's supposed to premiere in the forthcoming weeks called Made in Staten Island. It is, for all intents and purposes, a spinoff of Mob Wives. And it's got some of the offspring from those women in this show. Except this is on MTV, not VH1. And I saw the commercial and I nearly put my foot through the TV screen. There's actually, and this is one of those moments where I'll plead the case that sometimes Facebook can be of help, because many, many others from Staten Island saw this and are as fuming, if not more so, than I am. And they've gotten one of those petitions things going around, sign the petition to make sure that the show doesn't get on the air.
Oh, really? Wow.
Do not show this. Now, interestingly, and I don't mean to parlay this into anything more than what it is, but MTV was hyping to the skies, and I do mean hyping to the skies. In the late summer, a show called, I think it's called Pretty Little Mamas, that was supposed to be on Monday nights right after Floribama Shore came back for season two.
Okay.
I'm talking about hyped at every turn, every other commercial. It was on for two episodes and disappeared without a word. Period. That was it. No one said a word about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would hope that if this show makes it to air, the exact same thing happens. I'm hoping they do not air this, because just the commercial alone is offensive beyond words.
What is it? I mean, what's the problem? Because there's a thousand different ways to be offensive. What did they do?
First of all, one of those girls isn't even from New York. She's not from Staten Island, but she's the granddaughter of Sammy the Bull Gravano.
Oh, okay. All right.
She grew up in Arizona. Second of all, it's the same old tropes of they're Italian, they're mafia, they've already got police records, they think of themselves as the next, you know, the next big crime family. There's no mafia. Okay?
Right.
The mafia's been fragmented for years. You've got a couple of, you know, I don't even know what you want to call them, but, guys who deal in less than legal activity that may have Italian heritage. Okay? I think that's the fair way of putting it. But these assholes on this show are being every cliched stereotype cut from the cloth of every cliched stereotype.
It's a bunch of people who saw a bunch of episodes of The Sopranos and went, oh, I can play that part.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's offensive beyond words. It really is. I have zero Italian blood in me, and I'm completely offended by this, you know? And you know it takes a lot to offend me.
Right.
But because I'm still on Staten Island, you know? This is my home. This is my community. How dare you?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, and they don't care.
Somebody else, some other city, if you want to do that. Go shit on a town that really deserves it. Why come back to Staten Island to do this all over again?
Yeah, go to Short Hills. So, Oh, I'm sorry. Did I offend you, Short Hills? You're fine. You're fine. You're good.
Oh, so, my God. I'm going to go fire off an angry email just as soon as my nails are dry.
Now, a couple of other things that are going on before we hit the In Our Head segment this week, because I've never seen this movie, but you singled out a movie because I can't believe that this ridiculous argument is still going on of whether, what is it, whether Die Hard is actually a Christmas movie. And here we are on Christmas Eve, and there's still people having this fight. And of course, the answer is, I don't give a fuck. So, so that said,
I can put an answer to that right away, because there is, in fact, tonight, to buck against the annual TNT or TBS Christmas Story Marathon,
right?
Well, this time there's a Die Hard Marathon.
God. Okay, so whatever. I mean, whatever people choose to entertain themselves with, I don't care. But somehow, and this is the funny part about this, is that I have been able to successfully avoid for all of my 49 years, or at least as many, you know, going back to when they made this stupid movie, I have been able to avoid ever watching Love Actually. And the funny part about this is that it's the only one of those ridiculous romantic comedy slash, you know, serendipity type movies that I've ever had men recommend to me. Oh, dude, you've got to see Love Actually. It'll change your whole opinion of rom-coms and that whole, you know, subgenre. And I just don't care. I'm not going to waste my time with it, because I know even if I kind of like it, that's all it's ever going to be. And I'm going to go, eh, okay, sure, fine.
First of all, if you're a man and you like that movie, it just means that you're removing your testicles. And you're probably just transitioning. Bullshit. That's bullshit. It is the most nauseatingly poorly scripted lump of shit I ever sat through. And I sat through it when it was, like, when it first came on cable. So I've seen it uncut. But every year, every dipshit seems to watch it, you know, on whatever stupid station is running it. A very dear friend of mine, the glorious Mr. Alex Smith, who I've known for more than a quarter of a century now, and we were both writers many years ago, and I was at my first record label job. He is unfortunately tortured every year by his wife to sit down and watch this, and he will find every other reason in the world to not do so, justifiably so. And he has stated why this movie sucks. Again, it's a shit script. It's a stupid bunch of little vignettes. It's one of those ensemble films. It's, you know, this overly cutesy, to the point of you're sitting there trying not to vomit from the cutesiness. You know, the interplay between, you know, like, Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson and Andrew Lincoln and, you know, Hugh Grant is in it, and Bill Nighy, and I love Bill Nighy.
Sure.
Why he loved himself for this, I hope it was just a payday. That's all. But this is another one of those fucking Richard Curtis movies. Basically, it's the biggest piece of limp-wristed shit you could possibly watch. There are shitty movies, but this one is just gayer than gay. Okay, and I'm using gay in the right term, the right vernacular. And I that's the only thing you can call it. You know? People, if you're going to be offended by this, change the channel. Okay, it's that simple. This fucking movie is gay. G-H-E-Y, okay? Big neon letters. We're talking clang, clang, clang went the trolley gay.
Right.
It's just a shit movie, and anybody and everybody in that cast should have been slapped for it. Even Colin Firth, because I think he's a great actor. And he lowered himself to be in this. Impardonable. It's just one of those, it's a shitty movie, you know, and it just, it always pops up at Christmas, and it's lame, and it's typical. This is why I can't stand British movies, because they're all cut from the same shitty cloth. You've missed nothing, is what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, you know, I mean, every Hugh Grant movie, Notting Hill and all of the rest of them, oh, God, just
you know,
kill me.
He's just a girl standing in front of a boy wanting her to love him again or something like that.
Oh, I'm just a boy standing on a subway grate. Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing, just, I have no interest whatsoever, and I'm glad that you share the opinion. I've never even seen it, and
have to go back a bit, and not to cut you off, but it's just that, you know, my darling, beloved cousin Valerie always has a penchant for her comedic timing is flawless because she'll always say something that I know she knows is going to rub me the wrong way.
Uh-huh.
She'll say something completely inane, like, you know, oh, you should take Liz to go and see insert rom-com title here.
Right.
You know, you'll both love it. I'm like, haven't you ever met me?
Yeah.
Do I look like I'm, you know, I'm about to remove my cock and balls and say, oh, here, take these. I don't need them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no.
Yes. You
know, you're doing yourself a service. It's just a waste of time. You'd have more fun watching Homicide Hunter Lieutenant Joe Kenda marathon.
Now,
there's some sink your teeth into.
Yeah, there you go. And on the subject of movies, by the way, that have nothing really to do with Christmas per se, but Christmas plays a role in them, I can't do any better than Trading Places. I mean, I'm fine with that movie on every level. So if I need to, you know, have something where somebody wears a Santa suit halfway through it, I'm going to pick that one.
I don't even know. You know what? There's probably, they're staring at me in the face, I'm sure, but I can't think of a Christmas movie that really, or Christmassy movie that means anything. I'm more of the TV specials kind, you know?
Absolutely. Yep.
You know, give me Charlie Brown, give me Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know.
And I've mentioned
for 5 minutes, The Year Without a Santa Claus, just to see Snow Miser.
Exactly.
Okay, here's an argument you and I can discuss. Which camp are you in, Snow Miser or Heat Miser?
Oh, you know, because I am such a Buffalonian at heart, I got to go with a Snow Miser. I have no other choice.
I mean, it's Dick Shawn. That's all I have to say.
Exactly. Right.
That's all I have to say.
Another Buffalonian. Another Buffalonian, by the way. So, of course, he was the Snow Miser.
I mean, he was perfect. You know, and everybody's like, oh, but Heat Miser was so funny. No, he's not. He's small. He's round. He's red. He's fat. And he's slow. You know, and he's kind of, he just kind of sounds like a nasally Jewish guy, unlike the funny Jewish guy.
Exactly.
You know, that's an argument that we can settle right here on this show. It's like, how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop?
Three.
You know? Right. End of discussion. People do your homework. Yeah. We know the answer. I mean, John said it.
Yeah. And so, I'm all about the TV specials as well. And I've mentioned this one before because to the best of my knowledge, it only ever aired on TV once, but back in the late 70s, and I want to say it was 78, they did an animated cartoon, Doonesbury Christmas Special, and it's fantastic. I don't know why it died on the vine. I don't know why they never bring it back. It's so funny. And between that one, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas starring the Muppets, and let's see, what are some other good camp holiday specials? All of the Rankin Bass stuff. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you already named. Santa Claus is Coming to Town. With Burgermeister Meisterburger, you know, the worst Nazi parody ever in a Rankin Bass thing. He was great.
Well, I have no problem with Nazi parodies.
Oh yeah, me either. No, I love that thing. I watch it every time it comes on, and I mean all of them.
I, as a kid, I didn't hate Frosty the Snowman mainly because it came on right after Charlie Brown Christmas.
Right.
So I always equate one with the other.
Yep.
You know. Hell, I even like the Monkeys Christmas episode because it's kind of sweet.
Yeah, you know, of all the Christmas, now see, there's another kind of left turn at the traffic lights, because when you talk about Christmas episodes of TV shows, that's a different thing, because like there was the Brady Christmas special, A Very Brady Christmas, but that wasn't an episode. That was its own special. There was that horrible Star Wars Christmas special back in 77.
We
don't talk about that.
Ever. Never, never, never.
So bad.
Ever bring that up.
But when it comes to Christmas episodes, just the same way, and it kind of pales in comparison only because everybody remembers the line every year when it comes to Thanksgiving, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly. But really, the Christmas episode of WKRP in Cincinnati was golden because they did A Christmas Carol. And it was, it was Johnny Fever who was going through the sort of soul searching, and he was led through by all the different ghosts. And all I remember is that the ghost of Christmas Present was Venus, dressed up in like these Imperial Margarine King robes and stuff like that. And it was great. And again, because there is the Thanksgiving episode, everybody always forgets that one. But it was magic.
Well, you know, you brought up A Christmas Carol, and I just remembered, what's the greatest Christmas cartoon or animated show of all of them? Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
With, of course, the ultimate Christmas song, with razzleberry dressing.
Yeah. Right. Right. And one that everybody always forgets, because I know it, you know, again, we're talking about the same time. Boy, that Christmas of 77 and 78 was just a magic time for all of that stuff starting to come out on TV, because they also did something called An American Christmas Carol, and it was not animated. Henry Winkler.
But it was, there was a different name. That's right.
Yeah. And he played, the Bob Cratchit character, who was all, and they kind of flipped the roles around a little bit, because it was Cratchit who was, or no, I'm sorry, you were right. He was Scrooge. He was the young Scrooge who was just trying to run his factory and make it more efficient and all of that stuff. He really wasn't so much a bad guy. He was just a workaholic. And that's what ended up kind of taking his life away. But yeah, I remember seeing that the first time that it aired, and they made a big deal out of it, because he was still Fonzie at that point, and took some time off to do this thing. And it was the first time that he had really done anything dramatic on TV away from Happy Days. So it was a big deal, and I liked it. I thought it was pretty well done.
You know, it's not funny, actually, when you get right down to it, but one of my favorite quotes around Christmas time, of course, is whenever anybody comes up and gives me a sarcastic kind of, you know, Merry Christmas kind of thing.
Yeah.
I would always say to them, any fool that goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own Christmas pudding and have a stake of holly driven through his heart. I bid you good afternoon. When I say that, no one ever gets it.
Yeah.
No one ever gets where it comes from. And I did it last week among some of my colleagues. And they looked at me blankly, and I finally snapped and I said, have none of you ever fucking read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol? And the answer was collectively,
no.
No.
Right.
So you don't know the story of Ebenezer Scrooge? No. This is why we need to put me in office, and we need to start the culling. And what will happen is, we will begin a Christmas culling every year. So we're going to test all of you. Mine is like a greater form of Dianetics. Mine is an imperial power that will, you're either going to fall into my camp, or you're going to be deemed not a suppressor, but an irritation.
That's
and
right.
Irritation, I'm going to leave it to my hangman right here, John. To take care of you all.
That's right. You'll be dead to me in a very real sense. So
your next Hanukkah present will be your hood.
Now we have to end before we get to In Our Heads on a high note, because there is something going on musically, and
oh, yeah.
And I wasn't aware of this until you put it in our prep for today, because there are some bands who are getting back together for about the coolest project I've heard. You're gonna have to walk me through this though a little bit, because when I got to the Bangles are involved, I was immediately in.
Okay. So as many of you might remember, especially if you're faithful listeners to this show, the Paisley Underground, as it was so blithely called back in the early 80s, was, you know, the birth or rebirth, if you will, of neo-psychedelia / garage music. And L.A. seemed to be the ground zero for this, and the bands that were most well-known and led the way. And again, this is all subjective, because they're calling it the Paisley Underground is silly, but it fit these bands at the time. Were the Rain Parade, who, of course, had an immense impact on me, the 3 O'Clock, the Dream Syndicate, and the Bangles. And, of course, we all know that these four wonderful bands put out many, many great records, but they also had all gone by the end of the 80s.
Yeah.
Well, let's flash forward to a couple of years ago. One by one, they all started getting back together. Then the Bangles got back together. They put out an album, actually, called The Doll Revolution, which is taken from the Elvis Costello track, which was the title cut, Tear Off Your Own Head, It's a Doll Revolution. The 3 O'Clock got back together. The Dream Syndicate got back together. I saw them, and they were amazing. And the 3 O'Clock got back together and immediately went on Conan for no particular reason except to finally be on TV. And they've been playing sporadic shows and such, and they had talked about, now I need to take you back without losing you along the way. When these bands were all happening, they all pretty much worked out of the same studio, Radio Tokyo in LA, and they had an album that came out called Rainy Day. Now, this was just various members from these bands doing songs that they all liked. They covered Dylan. They covered The Velvet Underground. They covered Big Star. Okay? Et cetera, et cetera. And it was this kind of very warm, it is really the perfect Rainy Day album. You know, it's just these ethereal cover versions of songs. Well, the bands got to talking amongst themselves, we should do something not dissimilar. What they decided to do was what became this album that will be officially released January 19th. It already came out for Record Store Day, and it's going to be on Yep Rock Records, and the review is up right now on MusicApp. But what they decided to do is three songs by each of the four bands. So the album's called 3x4. So it's, you know, the Bangles covering the Rain Parade, the 3 o'clock covering the Bangles, the Rain Parade covering, you know, the Dream Syndicate covering the 3 o'clock. It's just this wonderful mix-up of doing each other's songs. And they take them and make them their own. They take them and put them in their own style and give them their own flavor and put a new life and new spin on them. I'll give you a perfect example, because I didn't want to give away too much in the review. It's an album you have to hear, because you're going to fall in love with it immediately. It's impossible not to.
Good.
Right? The opening track is the 3 o'clock doing the Bangles' Getting Out of Hand. Now, if you don't know this song, this was the very first single that they released when they were known as the Bangs, okay, in 1981. And instead of sounding like the vibe that you got when you hear the original single, you get that sort of "you did me wrong" kind of vibe. When you hear this version, it's a tougher "don't fuck with me" kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's great because it puts, I hate to say it, it puts big balls on this song. You know, it gives it a heftiness that, you know, the original version didn't have. I still love the original version, but this is just a neat slant on it, you know? Another example I'm going to give you is the Bangles doing the Rain Parade's Talking in My Sleep. I mean, it just, first of all, you know how I get about the Rain Parade.
Uh-huh.
I know how you get about the Rain Parade. So to hear Susanna's voice on this track, it's the perfect marriage. The perfect marriage. Not surprising, because Susanna was really close friends with the Robacks, who were in the Rain Parade, both David and Stephen. David Long having left and gone on to Mazzy Star, but Stephen is still with the Rain Parade. You know, Susanna Hoffs just does such an exquisite job with this. It's again, something you have to hear. But then the Rain Parade covers The Real World, the first track off the Bangles' debut EP.
Oh, nice.
Which is my favorite Bangles track. And, you know, it isn't often that you hear a male singing a song that was done from a female delivery and point of view. Because it's always the other way around, and they have to, you know, gender flip it and all that. But they do it perfectly, and they do it in that Rain Parade style. So it's not the upbeat, poppy, bouncy thing that you're used to from the Bangles. This is much more of a, it's far more cerebral. You know, it's a lot more of an emotional delivery than it is one of buoyance. So the long and short of it is, this is an album that should not be missed. You've got plenty of hang time to whet your appetites and prepare for it, because it is a great compilation of songs.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait. I mean, personally, I can't wait to give this thing a listen all the way through, because, like you said, it's talented musicians taking subject matter from other talented musicians in that same sort of idiom and doing something great with it. So I can't think of anything better. One last before we get to In Our Heads, and it's going to take us into the punk world for just a little bit, because we saw a punk rock bass player end up in a strange place for a punk rock bass player? Jackie Fuchs from the Runaways was on Jeopardy all last week, or almost all of last week, and they didn't even mention it until last Wednesday on the show when they were doing a little meet and greet with the contestants. Oh, by the way, weren't you in a band once? So she did really well. I think she walked away with over $80,000 before she finally was defeated late in the week. But it was that defeat that's been the subject of some, I don't know about controversy. It doesn't even seem like she's really all that wrapped up in feeling sorry for herself over this. But apparently, during the taping of the episode where she lost, she had a sugar crash, and it turned into what she described as a medical emergency right there on the show. And she said, if you watch closely, you can see she's having trouble forming words. Her, you know, her thumb wasn't working right on the buzzer, everything. And I know people who have had their sugar crash on them like that. And,
is she diabetic or hypoglycemic?
I think she's diabetic. And she described it exactly as what I've seen happen in front of me. So tough to go out that way, but still pretty damn cool that she won over 80 grand on Jeopardy.
Well, first of all, if that's the case, there should be zero controversy. If she's explaining the facts as it were,
right?
She is a lawyer, so I don't think she's going to have any problems. She's not going to sit there going, oh, it was this, oh, it was that, and making excuses. If she's stating it as, listen, I was having a sugar crash, and if you watch, you know, I just couldn't do it, you know?
Yep.
It says a lot more, you know, her own intestinal fortitude that she continued rather than saying, I'm sorry, I gotta go. I need a doctor.
Right. Or just falling over on stage.
Right. That's a little reckless, but, you know, a tip of the hat to her for it. Well, let's not forget when she was known as the irrepressible Jackie Fox.
Yep.
Is her name way back when she was in the she was also, unfortunately, the subject of one of the ugliest things I've ever heard in music, when it's been said on many occasions, and again, when she told the story, she was very matter-of-fact about it. Others who were witness to it said, this happened. Her former bandmates, including Joan Jett, which I find quite surprising, have said nothing. She was raped by Kim Fowley in front of a bunch of people. And she never spoke about it. And you know, it's one of those moments you can argue, well, why didn't she say something? She was 16, 17 years old, you know?
Right, and this is the guy who has her career and her life in his hands at that point. Right.
And you're, you know, it's the 70s, you know, people don't understand time, place, and context.
Right.
It's that simple. But she is one hell of I don't want to say tough, but definitely a resilient individual. And I admire that and I appreciate it. And from the time that I saw her on Jeopardy for the two nights I watched, she was pretty fucking good.
Oh yeah, she was.
I'm not good. I could win a couple of hundred grand. You could win 100 grand easy because we're both walking books of useless knowledge.
Right.
But she was damn good. And the great thing when I was watching her, and I'm sure you saw it too, is that she was very poised.
Right. And that really, I mean, more than anything else, that's what you see from the people who are longtime champions on that show, is that they don't get shook. And see, that's where I think it would fall apart for me, because I know what would happen in a situation like that is I would hit that one wrong answer that was something I knew and should have known, and the wrong word came out, or I second-guessed myself, and I would sit there and dwell on it. And that show moves so damn fast. If you sit there and dwell on something, you're shot. So
just frame it in the form of a question.
Exactly. I would have to practice that, you know, just keeping the controls on a lot before I went on that show.
Well, I'll tell you what, that woman who was on the show with Jackie, who couldn't answer the most obvious fucking answer in the world.
Right.
That was an embarrassment. That really was, because all you had to do was dissect the answer, you know. The first part was dedicated in 1934. The second part, duh.
Right. Yeah, the Mount Rushmore thing.
What was it called? U.S. Monuments?
Yes.
A road is not a monument, you fucking idiot. Go to school.
I see you watch Jeopardy exactly the same way I do, by yelling at the idiots on TV.
Sorry. What is, you are a fucking idiot.
So, yeah, again, congratulations to Jackie for padding her pocketbook a little bit on Jeopardy and making herself look really good, too. So, Yeah, no doubt. And now, that said, it is time to get to the In Our Head segment of the program. And because, as we mentioned earlier, you know, we didn't even get to talking about Donald Trump and all the idiot stuff he's been doing.
You know, it's Christmas. Let's take a break.
Yeah, let's do that.
All that anybody needs to know is that the Christmas tree in Washington, D.C. is not lit up because of the government shutdown.
Exactly. Right. So in that stead, let's go ahead and get to In Our Heads, because as I mentioned earlier, I spent the week in Kansas City and had an absolute wonderful time. It was nice to see radio done well for a change as well. So, you know, in my industry, not that many people really impress me, but they got a good thing going out there. So it started me to thinking about, of course, as I was driving in, all I had in my head was the song Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
Kansas City.
It kicked off a litany of songs in my head that all had not necessarily Kansas City, but just a city as their subject matter or as a hook or something like that. And I couldn't even come up with the one that had the most, because there's just so bloody many. But I mean, between New York City and Boston alone, you've got an incredible volume of songs that have been written about those cities. So I'm just going to hand this one over to you. I'll add in a couple of mine, but what are some of those songs that, whether it's in the title or not, they have a connection to a place that really stick out in your head?
Start spreading the news.
Gotta be the first one.
In no particular order, it's just by random thought because of the question. Obviously, New York, New York. New York Groove.
Song Ace's
Best. Philadelphia Freedom.
Yes.
Obviously, Dirty Water, because ooh, Boston, you're my home.
Mm-hmm.
For some stupid reason, I was thinking of Arizona by Mark Lindsay.
Or Indiana Wants Me. Remember that one?
Dean Taylor. Of course. Who doesn't know that movie? Because he also, there's a ghost in my house.
Yep.
Chuck Berry / Elvis. I think Elvis Presley's version is the one that wins, but. Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find the party, trying to get in touch with me. She could not leave a number, but I know who placed the call. Marco took the message and he wrote it on the wall.
And when we were doing the walking songs earlier, we mentioned Walking to New Orleans, and that song still has one of the best sort of clip-clop kind of grooves of any record ever.
Letter Never Sent by R.E.M. because of that line, Vacation in Athens is Calling.
No, yeah, and I mean,
song is very close to my heart.
Right, and we can stay with R.E.M. for a minute as well and talk about Don't Go Back to Rock.
No, it might sound strange, but I believe you'll be coming back before too long.
And Leaving New York. Yeah. See, they keep piling up. And it's funny because with Boston, you mentioned Dirty Water, and I think that's the one that they probably identify with the most. But I always like Boston Rag. I'm not the world's biggest Steely Dan fan, but boy, when they hit it right, they hit it right. And that song really hits a great tone.
Of course, another Sinatra song, L.A. Is My Lady, which leads me right to Randy Newman. I love L.A.
I love L.A. I love that song. Detroit Rock City.
Yes. Yeah. Looking Back, Texas. Yeah. Wayne and Billy and the Boys.
Right. Tallahassee Lassie.
What about geographically? You know, Southern Man, segue into its retaliation song, Sweet Home Alabama.
Sweet Home Alabama, right. Yeah, Southern Man don't need him around anyhow.
You know,
which one?
London Town by Paul McCartney and Wings.
Oh, right.
Paris Match by the Style Council.
And if you're going to start out with Frank Sinatra, we definitely have to throw in Tony Bennett, Anthony Benedetto, and a little bit of I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
Yeah, well, I'd leave my kidney in San Francisco because San Francisco ain't nothing in comparison to New York. Okay, here's one for real, because I am the master of obscurity. Brush Fire in Hoboken. Hold your on fire, the
my three sons. A book of insects sing along.
Fun pain with clang a clang. Or, you know, there's a song called Bonneville by the DBs. I mean, let's go for the gusto if we can think of this stuff, you know? Why not? You know, we got to give year-end shout-outs to Peter Holsapple and Chris Stainey anyway, so just because they bring so much musical joy.
Right. Well, and then there are the songs that are about 100 cities, like, what's the one, I've Been Everywhere, the one that Johnny Cash did?
Oh, yeah, but the most important one that Johnny Cash did is Jackson.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. But the other one that mentions a zillion different places is Sweet Little 16, back to Chuck Berry. Because they'll be rocking on bandstand in Philadelphia, PA, deep in the heart of Texas, around the Frisco Bay, all over St. Louis, way down in New Orleans.
Also, you know, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
See, we could do this all night, kids.
You know, Puffin needs eyeballs in New Orleans. Does that count? Puffin needs his grapes.
I'm going through and trying to find the most. You mentioned Hoboken, so I don't know if I can get more deep into the sort of, you know, second tier cities, because, you know, even
deep in the heart of Jersey by Uncle Floyd.
Right. Yeah, and I don't even know. I mean, I know there are people who have put it in songs in place of other cities, but my own hometown of Buffalo, I don't know if we've ever had a song written about us. Buffalo Gals, I guess, would be the closest one. Oh, and the song by Rock and Roll Girls by the guy from Creedence Clearwater Revival, John Fogerty.
Also wrote Lodi.
Yeah, which is a much better song.
But you can equate Lodi with either California or, worse, New Jersey.
Yeah,
I automatically do.
I wonder if he ever settled that, which one it was about. Because it's like writing a song about Springfield.
I think it was probably, I want to say it was California. I'd be shocked if he meant Lodi, New Jersey, because nobody does. Not even the people that live there.
Yeah, but imagine a worse place to be stuck.
I hate to say it, Homer that I am, shameless self-promoter that I am, I never state or say what exactly or where I'm singing about on the Punchlines classic track Train of Thought, but it's a song about Staten Island all the way through.
Yep.
My greatest love song is a love song to home and memory and time and place and history and the lack thereof, or the lack of respect of it. But I never, you know, when talking about the song, I tell you exactly what it's about. You know, it's one of those connect the dots moments, but I never do say that, you know, this is for Staten Island, except live. You know, I've said it a couple of times in gigs, but yeah, that's a song about Staten Island. And I don't think anybody's written anything else for Staten Island.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, as much as it irritates me, you know, New York City is the place where she said, "Hey, man, take a walk on the wild side," because I just can't stand Lou Reed. You know, I'm not a fan of any of that kind of shit, you know? So, you know, but I guess I have to throw it in there.
Yeah, and one last from me because again, I love the song and I love the town, but off of the, I think it was the Stray Cats' first studio release,
right?
18 Miles from Memphis.
Oh, I was going to say Rumble in Brighton.
Yep, right, Rumble in Brighton as well.
That's their greatest moment.
Yeah.
I mean, that song just fucking rocks and then some. I just thought of one, as much as it pains me. New York City by John Lennon. That, you know, the one really good song off of Sometime in New York City, the album.
Yep.
The one that goes, Que Pasa New York, Que Pasa New York. It's the only song that the guy did that I can probably say, wow, I really like the solo track.
Should we mention Billy Joel?
No. Because he has no soul. Oh, I'll go, well, you know what? But I was thinking, since you just said Billy Joel, you just made me reel off somebody else. Vienna by Ultravox.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
See?
Much better version, too. All right. Yeah,
I will take anything that is not Billy Joel.
We'll leave it there. Rob Ross, have a great Christmas Day, hours away as it is right now, and we'll reconvene next time around and do our thing again.
Yes, indeed, John. And to you and your family, have a wonderful, Merry Christmas. Enjoy the day. I'm glad that you are home safe and sound with your loved ones. We will do this next week, and everyone else, a very Merry Christmas to all of you, and thank you, as always.